Hey there, it's Frank Buckley. How about a diversion from the heavy news we've been experiencing recently with a little entertainment and inspiration? If you watch the show American Ninja Warrior on NBC, you know that that's kind of what you get on that program. They premiered their 12th season this week, and today on the audio podcast, it's a conversation with one of the show's hosts, Akbar Baja Biyamila. We talked to him last year when he was out with a new book, Everyone Can Be a Ninja, Find Your Inner Warrior and Achieve Your Dreams. Akbar has certainly done that. He's got a terrific backstory. Before the TV show, he played in the NFL, and long before that, he was a kid growing up in the Crenshaw community of South LA. He was one of seven kids, the son of first-generation Nigerian immigrants who were constantly working, kind of like Akbar now. I think you'll be inspired by his story. Here's my conversation with Akbar Baja Biyamila from April of 2019. Akbar Baja Biyamila, welcome.
Thank you so much, and you got it too. I know you were probably a little nervous, but you got it though. You nailed it.
And I said it because in your book, you make a point of talking about your Nigerian father.
Yeah.
Saying to you, make them say your name. Why did he say that?
Well, you know, growing up, especially in the 80s and 90s, to have a young kid, you know, that was from, you know, Nigerian descent, and a name that was just different from the Johns and the Larrys and the John, you know, the whatever. And I remember coming home to my dad because I was just teased relentlessly. That was me, my brothers, all of us. We were just teased relentlessly for our African heritage. And my dad said, you want to have another name, in his thick Nigerian accent? Think James Earl Jones from Coming to America. My dad, 6'3", 300 pounds, so he had a powerful, thick Nigerian accent. Goes, no, make them say your name. And I was like, oh, man. Like, I mean, you felt that when he said it.
Yeah.
And so I knew then that, you know, when my father spoke, I had to listen. So I just took more pride in just who I was, essentially. And I remember there was a turn. There was a shift in consciousness and awareness of who I was. What I was, I realized that, yes, okay, you know, my parents came to this country in the late 70s, early 60s, escaping from the Biafra War in Nigeria. And so there was a sense of pride in when you come to America to make a name, to make it for yourself. So I took that on, and I took it wholeheartedly.
And your name actually has a very important meaning.
Yes. I mean, you're not just given a name randomly. You know, they're not just putting stuff together. You're named according to how you're born. And so, and part of that Nigerian culture is to give a name with meaning. And so Akbar means great. Oluwakemi means, you know, like child of God. And then Idowu means born after twins. And then Baja Biyamila means born after, big man come save me. And my great-great-grandfather was a 7-foot mediator in the village. And so whenever people would have issues, they would say, Balajag Biyamila, meaning big man, come and save me. Mm. So my dad would tell me also that, you know, you have a big responsibility being the tall kid in class. You know, I'm awkward and I'm tall. So he instilled a lot of pride in that you have to be comfortable with who you are.
Yeah. I learned in your book, Everyone Can Be a Ninja.
Yeah.
That even though you became a professional football player,
yeah,
you first wanted to be a basketball player.
Look, I grew up here in Los Angeles, and all I remember was the Los Angeles Lakers. I was in love with the Lakers. My first girlfriend was a basketball. I would dribble. That's all I ever had dreams of doing. I was certain that I was going to be playing alongside Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Magic Johnson, A.C. Green, Byron Scott. Those guys, I mean, I was going to be coming off the bench with, you know, with Michael Thompson. I don't know. I was
right.
Just like, you know, but I knew that that was going to be my goal. And but after I got to a certain point, I realized that, you know, when I finally peaked out in high school at about 6'5", that I wasn't going to be going to the NBA. I wasn't going to be getting a college scholarship. And my high school coaches, they really pushed me to play football. I eventually accepted. I quit. My dad made me come back. And then I took the challenge and said, you know what? Let me just go ahead and embrace this football thing. And to my surprise, I was able to get a football scholarship. But
let's back that up for a second, because you kind of skimmed through it.
Yeah.
But in your book, you go into detail about that first practice and crying behind that helmet.
Man, that was the hardest thing. It was barbaric. Like, yeah. Football was not meant for humans. It yeah. was just straight up barbaric. And I remember that very first day of football practice, coach had me come out. I had my pads on backward. My thigh pads were on backwards. I had it facing towards me. Oh. The knee pads were upside down. I came out in my basketball, Nike shoes. And
yeah,
I
they had to get you cleats.
Cleats from UCLA. I'll never forget, because size 15 cleats. My parents couldn't afford no cleats because the shoes I got was free from playing on the basketball team. And so my first day of practice, we're in basketball shoes. Of course, I'm sliding. Oh. But my coach is throwing me, and just, I mean, I don't know anything about football. I didn't watch it. I knew my brother played it, and I supported him, but I could care less. I only knew football from Tecmo Bowl. That's the only thing I knew. And I always played with the Miami Dolphins and Dan Marino, John Offerdahl, the Mark brothers. That was it. That's all I knew.
Yeah.
But when I got out there, and I just remember, like, on goal line, and I was crying underneath my helmet, like, gosh, like, what did I get myself into? I mean, bruises and bumps, and I'm like, this is some nonsense. Yeah. Like, this is barbaric. I don't want to do this. And after a couple of practices, I just went home. I was like, you know, why am I putting myself through? And when you're a basketball player at Crenshaw High School, you kind of got a little bit of arrogance. Like, this is the top program right. in the country.
I'm an elite athlete.
And I'm playing at Crenshaw High School, which was like the junior Laker team.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't need this. I said, I'm done. I told the coach, like, I don't need you guys. I play on the basketball team. My dad heard that. You did what? No, you started. You finish it. Oh, man, if you don't play football, you don't play basketball. I was like, oh, my life is over. No, my life is over. So I ended up playing it, and it changed my life. It really yeah. did change the trajectory of my life.
You said that first season was awful, but then you came back, I guess, better prepared for the second season. You knew what the expectation was.
Yeah, I knew what the expectation was. I knew that I was in it. And so, and I think to me, that's part of a life lesson. When you stay committed to something, there's this attitude that I had that, this wasn't me. I was unfamiliar with it. I wasn't willing to give it a chance. But my father making me play really then allowed me to say, okay, well, I'm in it, so I might as well fully commit to it. And committing to it, it allowed me to be more receptive to just outside instruction. And sometimes in our own personal lives, we're not committed to certain things. And so we have this pride that I know it all, I know what I'm doing, and we don't get some of the outside influence of people who could actually be instrumental in our growth. And so Coach Garrett at Crenshaw High School, who's still there, was very instrumental in my growth in developing. But he punished me that first year. Like, I didn't play at all in my 11th grade year. He just made me sit on the sideline and say, you want to be this, brat, then I'm And so I sat on the sidelines, and then the last game of my junior year, I got a little bit of action. And then my senior year, I said, you know what, Akbar, just fully commit. And I committed, and it worked out well for me.
And ended up at San Diego State.
Yeah, I got a scholarship for San Diego State. It was crazy to be recruited. Cal Berkeley, I remember Hugh Jackson coming to campus, and San Diego State and Oregon and Fresno, Colorado State. And it was like, wow, like, this is a big deal. Yeah. But I would have never been in that position. You know how many basketball offers I got? Zero.
Yeah.
Zero. I was like, all the years I played basketball, and I got zero. I would have taken the lowest of the lowest basketball scholarship if they would have came. But I got zero.
But a lot of good lessons in
yes,
that and
yeah.
life lessons.
Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned your father quite a bit, and your mother was a huge influence in your life as well. And I want to ask you about the religion. Your father practiced Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother was a Christian. I know later in life you turned to Christianity.
Yes.
And I wonder, why did you choose the Christian path, and what influence did that have in your life, having parents who were of different faiths?
Well, I think the biggest lesson that I took away from growing up in a dual religious household is tolerance. Mm. And especially now, I think about all of the riffraff between, in Islam and Christianity and any type of different religion, but it gave me tolerance, but also conviction too in my own faith. I remember growing up as a child going to Sunday school, and then the day before I'd be in Arabic class, learning to write in Arabic. So I'm going from really writing from right to left, then Sunday school, writing left to right,
wow.
which was different. And, praying in the mosque, then praying in church. And it was confusing, but not confusing because it was my norm at the time. But I associated with Islam because my father was the head of the household, and that's just how I associated. But my mother and father would have really, I mean, debates in the House, but they weren't, you know, they pull out the Quran, pull out the Bible. And I remember them sometime going low. No, I'm tired. I'm going to bed. But they would be going back and forth and Jesus and Muhammad and so on and so forth.
In a civilized way.
In a civilized way. Yeah. And so sometimes they would get animated, but it was never like, no, no, yeah, check this out. But it was never anything that was bad. And the fact that when we would pray, I mean, that was mandatory. We had to pray. You wake up. You couldn't even brush your teeth. Did you pray? And when we prayed together as a family, we played. My father would always pray in Arabic. My mother would pray in English in a Christian prayer. And it was civilized. And we would all be together as a family. All nine of us come together. But it taught me later in life. So I would practice Ramadan all the way up until my sophomore year in college I practiced Islam. And it was a turning point for me that I realized that I was Muslim because of my father. And I wasn't Muslim because, you know, it was what I chose. So I took about a year off where I still believed in God, but I didn't identify with a religion. I wanted to be able to make my decision. And I think that's a part of the growing process, too, the maturation rate. When you're going into college, you're trying to discover who you are.
Yeah.
And I knew for me that I needed to find what worked for me, what I truly believe in. Because I didn't know what I believed in. I knew about Islam, I knew about Christian, but I didn't really know. And there were like three or four of us on the team that we'd practice Ramadan together. And I remember I had a series of dreams that really, you know, felt like that really I felt convicted, like, man, I need to give my life to Christ. And I remember making that decision, and it helped to have a pastor who was different than the churches that I grew up. I grew up in a traditional black church where there was a lot of hooting and hollering, but I didn't really get down to the fundamentals of learning a lot about the Bible. And Pastor Miles McPherson down in San Diego, he was a teacher. And I started to learn and learn and learn. And that's when I go, okay, I'm making the decision to convert to Christianity.
Did it hurt your father that you converted to Christianity?
I yes and no. But my dad was always, and to this day, has always been, like, you know, very accepting of, you know, who we are. But I remember him saying, I can still remember his way. He goes, I figured that when I came to this country that you guys would be westernized and that this could happen. Those were his words. And I remember him saying that. But he's like, okay. That was it. Like, okay. But it wasn't like it caused any riffraff or anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, my dad will call me and say Merry Christmas. And he would call me. So my dad has just always been like that. So he was always ahead in that way. So.
You're one of seven children.
Mm-hmm.
Your family is the classic immigrant story. Your parents come here. They want, quote unquote, better lives for you.
The American dream.
Yeah. They work and work and work. They both worked hard. They send you and they instill in you this value of education. And are they proud? I think your mother has passed.
Yes.
But your father, proud of you?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. In the Nigerian culture, you don't get this participation trophy. You don't get the good job if you didn't do a good job, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And I remember when I graduated from elementary, you know, looking to dad to say, good job. You know, well, you always say this, and I even do it to my kids. Well, you're a big kid now. You're going to junior high school. You're going to junior high school. You have to get ready for the seventh grade. So it was just like, man, like, but I just graduated. Are you going to tell me congratulations?
Yeah.
I graduated from junior high. Well, you're a big boy now. You are going to high school. I'm like, gosh.
Right. And he never went to any of your football games either,
no,
right?
No, he didn't. And I now know why. But growing up, I took it personally.
Yeah.
And which really developed, I developed a lot of insecurities that I even battle to today. But obviously, I know now as a parent of four what it must be like trying to get to all your kids' events. I mean, it's almost impossible when, you know, you're a plumber and, you know, my mom was a hairstylist. Like, how do you support a family of seven on that type of salary? Like, my dad's Superman now, more so now than I knew as a kid. But when you're a kid, you're selfish and you only have your singular perspective on what, you know, the expectations of your parents should be.
Yeah.
But it was unrealistic for my dad to be working in Chino and then trying to get down to Crenshaw to come watch a game, you know.
Yeah.
But it meant something to me for him to come to my game. But no, to your point, like, you know, education was, I mean, they harped on that. You got to get your education. So when I graduated from college, I'll never forget. I was driving down 42nd Street heading towards Arlington. And I asked my dad, I said, Dad, are you proud of me? I graduated from college. Well, you have to get ready for the real world. I'm like, oh, my gosh. I'm like, just Dad, give it to me.
Right.
But it wasn't until after my second year in the NFL, my dad called me and was like, you know, I'm proud of you. I mean, I couldn't even hold it back. I was like, whoa. And it wasn't prompted. You know, it was just, he told me, it was just like, because I think too, for the Nigerian parents, my dad didn't get the, even though my brother was already in the NFL, he didn't really get that you could be successful and, you know, make a living playing sports because he thought it was recreational. My dad looked at sports as, what is all this recreational stuff? I can't talk about my dad without doing the accent. So, but what is all these recreational stuff? And then even when I got my bachelor's, you better get your master's degree. Get your master's degree. It's not master's, master. You have to get your master's degree. And so I just remember him, you know, really harping on that. But once he realized, like, wow, this is their career choice, they're athletes, he accepted it. And just like he's been always loving in that department.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
When you were playing football at San Diego State, you talked about being in the NFL, but you had this idea that, okay, and people had talked to you and said, you're going to get drafted. So just stand by the phone.
Yeah.
Draft day comes, and what happens?
Draft day was that was horrible. You know, you go into it's almost like you know you're going to get picked to. You knew it was going to happen. I knew I didn't know I didn't think it was going to be the first or second or third round, but I thought I could be you know fourth or fifth. Fourth was just like dreaming. Fifth would be like okay, this is realistic. This is probably where I should go. And when the fifth round went, the sixth round went, the seventh round went, I'm like, man, okay, well, this is humbling, but at least I'll be drafted. And when that Mr. Irrelevant would happen, and I'm like, oh, my goodness. I mean, I stormed out of my friend's house just, again, crying and upset. And then reality hit. I remember thinking, oh, my goodness, I don't know what career path I'm going to go down. Mm. I don't know what I'm going to be doing for a living. Like, I'm done with college.
Yeah.
Football is clearly over. And an hour later, my agent calls me and says, how about Silver and Black? I'm like, absolutely. Like at this point, anything sounds good at this point. But it was cool that I got drafted or, you know, came in as an undrafted free agent. But I'll never forget the fear that came over me and where it's like, and I'd imagine anybody graduating college thinks, what am I going to do next? Because there's the idea of being incubated in this, you know, college environment, knowing that, okay, hey, you know, I'm working towards a degree and I'm working towards being successful. But when you get out in the real world, you go, hold on, what does that look like? Where do I start? How do I start? There's a whole nother class and a whole nother life lesson about that.
Right. And the fact that you made the team as an undrafted free agent, I mean, that's a huge accomplishment.
Not in my wildest dream. Again, that insecurity. We're talking about my father, you know, not coming to my games. He went to one game of mine in high school. It was one of the biggest games ever. We had Denzel Washington there. I remember Jaleel White, who I'm now friends with. He was there. This was the biggest game. It was the Crenshaw High School at the Pauley Pavilion against Compton Dominguez. And it was just packed. Tayshaun Prince was on that team. Kenny Bruner, Jason Thomas. And we were it was a sold out arena. And I said, Dad, I just remember saying, Dad, you got to make it to this game. I just kept harping, you got to make it to this game. It was the biggest game of my life, you know, and he showed up. And so I'll never forget that, you know. But I think back to, you know, getting to the Raiders and this insecurity of not having my father, you know, see me play basketball. He saw me at San Diego State. He came to a lot of my games at San Diego State, but I still was struggling with this insecurity. And so part of me didn't think I had a chance to make the Raiders. They drafted Tyler Brayton in the first round. They drafted Sam Williams, who is a linebacker / defensive end out of Fresno State in the third round. They drafted Sharon Pierce out of USF, and he was fast as get out, like a 4.2 guy. I'm like, oh, my goodness. I ran a 4.59. I was like, I don't have a chance. This guy's blazing fast. And then they had veteran Trace Armstrong, who had been in the league for 100 years already but was still, you know, very, you know, present in the league. And then they had Tony Bryant, who was coming out. I'm like, when you talk about everything is stacked against you, I knew that. And then on top of that, they gave me number 69.
Right.
And you can know all the colorful jokes that came out of me wearing number 69. All they gave it to me. And I'm just
and that's not. And that's not a linebacker.
That's not a
number.
Defensive line
right.
number. Like
right.
that's like defensive saying you're a dirtbag. Like
yeah,
you're
yeah.
you don't. I mean, you're not to be respected.
Right.
I mean, you could at least give me a 90 number. You gave me a 60, an offensive lineman number.
Right.
I knew. And then on top of that, I was in the auxiliary locker room. I wasn't even in the main locker room.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, you know, I got some work to put in. And man, I made it through the first cut, the second cut, and then the last cut comes, and I literally had my watch on my wrist underneath my glove because I was looking, and I knew that it was 1 p.m. PST, 4 p.m. Eastern time. I'll never forget that time like that. That's the final roster. And that was about 3 or 4 minutes before. And I was hiding like an idiot. Now, don't judge me. I was hiding behind the door in the auxiliary locker room, hoping for the Grim Reaper. The Grim Reaper is the guy who comes and says, hey, coach wants to see you. And you know what that means. That's code for you out of here. And I was hiding. I was like, oh, man, but I can't be late for practice because then I'm going to get cut because I was late. I'm like, man. And I just remember I was waiting for the hallway because you can look through the crack of the door. I'm looking, waiting for the hallway to be clear. I said, all right, I'm going to scoot out here because I just knew that they were looking for me, but they couldn't find me. And so I go out there and I remember Bill Romanowski slaps me on the butt. He goes, congratulations. And I was like, Bill, man, I still got 2 more minutes. Like, I haven't made it. And when the horn went off, I'm like, oh, my word. I don't think that I even had a good practice that day. Because I was in another place.
Yeah.
Like, oh my goodness. I sat in my hotel room and I'm just staring like, oh my word. For like an hour before I even called anyone, I was like, I made the team. Like, I'm in the NFL.
Yeah.
It was just a surreal moment. I called my brother who was with the Packers at the time, and I think he felt my insecurity. I called him and said, man, you got cut. I was like, no, I made the team. That was just... And then it hit me like I didn't even know where I was going to live. I had to be at the hotel the next day. I had
wow.
nowhere to live. I didn't plan for it. I didn't, right. you know. So my buddy Namdi, who I talk about in the book, Namdi Osman, said, "Man, you can room with me." So
yeah.
It was a blessing that I had a friend in Namdi who we shared the Nigerian commonality. But he said, "Yeah, you come room with me."
And now you
yeah.
serve on his foundation,
yes.
and you help him out when
yeah.
you can. If that was maybe one of the best days of your NFL life. What was the worst day?
I think the worst day for me was getting cut in 2005 and knowing that afterwards, knowing that I wouldn't get picked up in the 2005 season. I got cut September 3rd, 2005. These dates, they stick in your head, man,
yeah.
when you have these. That was the first time I got cut in the NFL, and I was sure that I was going to get picked up. I went out and tried out for the Green Bay Packers and the Houston Texans and the Dallas Cowboys. And I went to all these different teams to go try out. I was for sure that I'm going to land somewhere. I didn't. In that 2005 season, I just sat at home and I was just like, what am I doing with my life? What am I going to do? This is it. 2 years and I'm done. I said, wow, I guess the average career in the NFL is 2.5 years. I was like, oh, it's just under 2.5. I didn't even make it to half.
Yeah.
And that to me was probably devastating because I hit an all-time low. And most people don't realize that in the two other times that I got cut, you hit this low. This is something that you've invested your body, your life, everything into it. And when it doesn't work out, it's very hard to bounce back. And most people think, oh, you make money. You should just bounce back. You don't have feelings. You're not human. I mean, like that's just think about anything you've invested a lot in and it dips down. Maybe you're a financial guy and you invest and your investment takes a tank. I mean, it's a shocker. And then the rebuild after that, or look at the housing market or relationships or whatever
it is in life.
Or if
you have any kind of a job that you've yeah. worked your whole life toward and you get fired
right.
or laid off. It's a
shock to the
yeah,
system.
Yeah.
And so regardless of what industry, personal issues, and that's why this book, Everyone Can Be a Ninja, really just talks about all the different obstacles that I had to overcome. And then it gives steps to how to overcome them. And for me, I had to really get out of my feelings and start developing a plan. Because the lack of planning would only further that depression, further that sense of, you know, whatever the insecurities that come out. And for me, it was just, you know, that I wasn't good enough. That's the one thing that always gripped me was that I'm not good enough.
I want to get to American Ninja Warrior and your work on the show, but before you got there, before you got to the NFL Network, you put in the work to become a broadcaster, to learn the skills that you would later use.
Right.
And you did a lot of it not making any money. You went to boot camp, to literally to NFL announcers boot camp for players.
Right.
And you were selected for that. So talk to folks about how much work you had to do to learn to be this guy that we see on TV now.
Frank, you know, you see so many people who leave the game with big names, high profile, Hall of Fame, Super Bowl, and they usually reserve these guys for some of the big analyst jobs, broadcasting jobs in the industry. I was none of those. And I knew that I really wanted to, after I came out of my depression, that I really wanted to focus and getting into this career. And for many people, they looked at me as like, Akbar, it's unrealistic. And it felt unrealistic. And so the plan that I devised was, to me, there's two things. Two people that I think were very instrumental in me taking this career path. One were my parents, because they were hustlers. Hustlers in that they always constantly, I mean, my dad went from ice cream truck to working for somebody to then to getting his own job. My mom did real estate. She did hair. She finally settled on hair. But she was constantly trying to figure out, how do you provide? How do you find your way? And so I never forgot that, seeing that growing up. But then it was Fred Brown and Al Jaffe at ESPN who I interviewed with them. And essentially they told me, dude, you got to get some footage. And I'm like, who's going to give me footage? That's why I'm interviewing with you. Give me the chance. No one was going to give me the chance. And so I devised a plan that I was going to go back to the place where I had the most amount of equity, which was San Diego. Mm-hmm. I played for the Chargers for 1 year, played for San Diego State for 4 years. I went to the local NBC station and I said, hey, look, my name is Akbar. I introduced myself. And I said, I'd love to call the post-game and for the Chargers and the Aztecs, and I'll do it for free. And they looked at me and they go, for free? I was like, yeah, there's a hired right there and there. I was just hired, and I did it for free. And I came in every week during the football season for 2 years, and I developed my skill set from there, and that became my internship. I created essentially my own internship working there, and that led to me calling college football games for CBS College, then to NBC Sports, doing the Pac-12 for the 1 year that they had it. And that really is what jumped off my sport, my broadcast / hosting career. But had I not invested in my belief, had I not invested and pushed past fear, because there's a fear of rejection, like, who's going to take me? Because, again, there's this thing, and I don't know how many of the listeners really can relate to that feeling of, I'm not good enough. And if you feel like you're not good enough, it's like, well, why try? Why would I even try to even make that attempt?
Yep.
And most people will look at me and go, you're arrogant to think that you could walk out. I still will never forget that day. I literally said, I'm leaving my house right now, unannounced. I didn't call ahead and say, hey, I want to do it. I just knocked and said, hey, who do I need to speak to? They introduced me to the director, the news director. And before you know it, it was do-do-do-do. And it was just like that, because there are a lot of retired guys in San Diego.
Yeah.
But they all felt they needed to be paid if they were going to talk football. I said, I'll do it for free.
Right. By the time you get the job to do American Ninja Warrior, you're a seasoned broadcaster. You've done it. You've done broadcasts. You're good at this. You've learned that skill. But this is a different skill to host this show. And you write right off the bat in your book about the epic fail of your first day, and really it seemed like your first season.
Yeah, that was the worst day until this day. I don't like watching season 5 of American Ninja Warrior. In fact, I don't even know why I said the season, because now people are going to look it up. I don't want people to look at that. But season 5 was so hard for me. I'll never forget that the skill set was different. Calling college football games, calling, calling the action is different, because a lot of that comes from my experience. I'm just talking about what I'm seeing and how do I make that. But I didn't have to do a lot. Some of the analysis I came up with in my head, or the opens that you did, was like, okay, hey, look, this is what I'm seeing. I'm just talking to how, like, I'm talking to you.
Yeah.
So it came very natural. But then when I got to the entertainment side, a lot of that stuff is produced on what your open's going to be like, what to look for. Here's what. That stuff was different.
And it seemed like they just kind of threw you into it.
I auditioned for it, thinking that was great. They called me, said, you got it 2 weeks later. You start in 2 weeks. I'm like, okay, all right, cool. Here we go. I was scared. I didn't necessarily want to take it. I try to actually find ways to self-sabotage the fact that I got it because it was just like, again, this is primetime television.
Yeah.
And I'm like, whoa, I accelerated faster than I had anticipated for my own self. And so part of me was trying to say, well, maybe I got a family emergency. Maybe I have something to say. Well, maybe I should just stick in football and just stay with football. And I don't really want to do this because I was really afraid. Huh. And so I was trying to, you know, psychologically find an excuse not to accept the offer. But I couldn't get myself to quit and not accept the offer. So I accepted it. I get there on set. They hand me a script. Say, Akbar, you need to memorize this in 30 minutes and you're on air. I get makeup coming to me, and they're knocking. And every 5 minutes, I'm not even every five, maybe every 3 to 4 minutes, I'm getting a knock on your door. We got wardrobe, knock, knock, knock. We got makeup, knock, knock, knock. Script change, knock, knock, knock. I'm like, man, if these people don't stop, and I was about to turn hood on them, like, because, you know, growing up in the hood, you just can't be going up knocking on people's door like that, like, because you think it's the cops. I'm like, stop knocking on my door is what I wanted to.
Because you're
I'm
trying to memorize this thing.
I'm trying to memorize, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm trying to memorize this, and they're tying my shoes. Like, first off, I can tie my own shoes. Like, just leave me alone. And they rush me out of there. They put the IFB in it. I'm on stage, and I can't remember it. Then one of the producers gets the bright idea that they're going to feed me the line in my ears. And you know.
Yeah.
Frank, that's
horrible.
Trying to horrible.
Speak while someone's talking to you.
And I'm like, hi, this is Akbar, and we're here in Los Angeles. And this is and I'm like, at this point, I'm humiliated. I'm like, oh, my goodness, I'm humiliated. And on top of that, it's out to a live audience. So the live audience can hear my struggle.
Yeah.
And now I'm starting to get heckled. Come on, you can do it. And this, I'm like, you know, and I'm trying to, and Matt Eisman, who, bless his heart,
yeah.
I'm sure he was frustrated with me. I'm sure, never showed it. So then I come up with the bright idea. You know what? I seen them at the NFL Network read from teleprompter. That's what I need because I can't memorize, right? I can't memorize. Bring out a teleprompter. Now, mind you, as an analyst on the NFL Network, all I do is give my opinions.
Right.
And so I'm just going off the cuff.
Read off a teleprompter.
I don't read anything. I know what I'm talking about.
Right.
They bring out the teleprompter. I can't read. I feel like an idiot. Completely. I cannot read the teleprompter. I know how to read, but I just couldn't read it. And then the people again, come on, it says this. And the fans are saying, I'm like, could somebody just close my mic and not broadcast it? Because this is embarrassing. And I can just hear the producers, like, they were a little late off of the thing. Like, just go to runs. Like, I could tell they were frustrated with me. This is epic failure. Over 40 minutes, I'm trying to do this open line.
Oh.
It was, and Matt is just sitting there. It was like, I think you mean. And then I'm misreading it. And I'm putting words that are not there. It's not my words. I don't speak like this. It was just a disaster. It was a complete disaster. That carried on for the entire season, for season 5.
Yeah.
And I remember my last day. Filming in Las Vegas for the finals, I literally shook the hands of every producer, said, thank you so much. And it was a thank you.
Because you thought that was it.
You couldn't tell me that I was coming back. You couldn't tell me. I was like, oh, no, I'm done. So I just, at least before they tell me I'm done, I do want to say thank you for the opportunity. I learned so much. I was giving my goodbye speeches to all the producers. I mean, I could not believe that they brought me back.
And to hear you tell that story, and to see you now, it seems like two different human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And so how did you overcome that? Because by season 2, you were fine.
I had to accept my deficiencies. And part of it was I wasn't used to reading out loud, that this was a whole new skill set. And there were areas that I did make a lot of mistakes, and I had to be able to own that. And I think the hardest part in life is to be able to look at yourself, because I truly believe that the hardest person to get to know is yourself, because we can deny anything. We can make excuses like, oh, it's because these people were in front of me, or this happened, or, I went to a public school. Whatever the excuses are, we can deny whatever. And I try to encourage people in the book to be able to look within and to be able to accept those deficiencies that you have. And it kind of took me back to the locker room, because there's a saying in the football world, and I'm sure too in any sport world, that the eye in the sky doesn't lie. Because when you make a mistake on the football field, the all 22 cameras looking down, it sees everything. You can't say, well, coach, I did this and this. No, I see that.
He didn't do Monday that. Films.
Yeah, Monday Morning Films was, oh boy, and you would get chewed out. But right. I lost some of that along the way, and I had to recapture that. Mm. And for a lot of us, we don't have people in our lives that will tell us the truth. And I think you know this. After every show, you might know internally, I could have done better on this show. I could have. And everybody says, great job, great job, great job, great job. But we also have people like that in our own personal life that just maybe are afraid or not. They don't have the courage to tell you that, hey, this is an area where you need to work on. Mm-hmm. I'm noticing this in you. And we may not even welcome that. We may be giving something in our own life or in our own personality that we say, I don't welcome any type of critique of me. Mm-hmm. Because people see us more than we see ourselves. And that might sound weird, but if you think about it, people see me. If I stay around you for a long time, I can know what irritates you. I can pick up on just different things that you may not. Hey, do you notice you do this? Do you notice you do that? Like, no, I didn't even notice that did it. Because you just don't want to notice these things about yourselves. Yeah. And so I think that was the turning point of me being able to reflect and be introspective. And then getting the confidence. I remember one of the producers, Kent Weed, the director, Patrick McManus, said, man, Akbar, I watched some of your old games when you're doing CBS. I want you to be more like that. I was insecure. I thought, you know, it wasn't lost on me that I was the first African-American host on American Ninja Warrior. And I thought, oh, maybe I sound too black or maybe I'm too hood or, you know, maybe, you know, they want me to sound a certain. In fact, that first year, one of my boys came to me in the gym and was like, dude. And in the black community, it's tough when somebody goes, man, you sound like the other dude. You sound white. And when you hear that, it's like, oh, my goodness. You know, and I'd always been kind of teased that, oh, you speak proper, whatever that means. Or white, which means proper, which is but the way they said it, I knew
it was insult.
It was an insult, and I wasn't being authentic. And it was true. It was true. I was trying to mimic the cadence of my partner because I thought, well, he's been doing it a long time. So maybe they want me to sound like this. And they would overcorrect me in the way I would enunciate things and pronounce, you know, it needs to be pronounced. I'm like, oh my goodness. Like, this is like, that is not good. I'm like, but I don't speak like that.
Right.
Like, you know, you barely hear the T at the end of my that because it's like, that guy's good.
Right.
You know, like, you didn't hear the D. Like, you just got to let me be. And they allowed me to just kind of really just be you. Just be you. We have you here to be you. And I would start throwing out little slangs that I would say, little sayings I was saying. I was like, oh, nobody's stopping me from doing. I can say this, and I said, dang! And I was like, oh, that went by. Oh, and then before you know it, I just started growing more confidence. And it's amazing if you apply that to your own personal life. The courage to be you gives you that confidence. The minute you try to be someone else, the minute you think that you have to play to someone else's strength, that's when you lose.
Yeah,
that's when you lose.
You focus on a number of the ninjas that you have met in the show, and you're clearly inspired by some of these folks. And one thing I was surprised to read is that you tell us when people come on the show, most of the time they're not trying to win the show. They've already won by qualifying to be on the show. How have they inspired you? And maybe pick one of them to give us an example of that.
Well, Zach Gowen sticks out to me. I speak about three different ninjas in my book. But Zach Gowen, because we have excuses. I think it's a part of human nature to deal with whatever we deal with on the inside. We use excuses. And Zach Gowen is a guy who's competing on the show and is an amputee. He's competing with a prosthetic leg. And he takes his prosthetic leg. Now, we've had other amputees compete on the show, but none like Zach Gowen, who's a former wrestler as well. And he took his prosthetic leg, and I remember him holding it up. And I thought he was holding it up to show everybody, look, I've got a prosthetic leg.
Yeah.
No. He was like, I have a prosthetic leg, and I'm about to toss it off to the side. He tossed it off. And if you've ever watched American Ninja Warrior, you know the very first obstacle is an agility obstacle that requires both legs because you're doing the quad steps or the floating steps, and you got to go side to side to side, lateral going side to side. He does it with one leg, and he's hopping off to one thing, hopping off to another thing. My mouth just dropped. And what came to my mind is, what's your excuse? This dude just took off his prosthetic leg and tossed it. You need that, homie. Like, you need that. And he's like, no, I don't. So his disability wasn't what we saw it. It was actually his ability. It gave him the forward and the moxie to be able to attack the most difficult obstacle course in the world. And then I started applying that to our own life, my own life. And then I try to put that in the book as far as like, think about your own personal life and think about maybe some of the areas that you consider your disability and using your own ability to be able to tackle some of the hardest and most difficult obstacles in your own personal life. And if we had that Zach Gowen type mentality, that moxie to move forward, I think you'll see a lot more success in people. You'll experience more success. You get closer and closer to your own greatness. Yeah. And that's where I think for me, I had to really look at him and go, man, like I never forgot that run ever. It wasn't the most dynamic run, but it was the most memorable. When you see a guy taking on an agility course and then getting onto the rolling log and he's spinning and you just see one leg spinning over and over, it was just memorable. It's burned into my brain. It's burned into my heart that no matter what the obstacles are in front of you, you take it the way you are. You approach it the way you are. You don't have to be anyone else. He didn't have to be anything else but Zach Gowen.
Yeah. Well, that story and more in the book, Everyone Can Be a Ninja. Find your inner warrior and achieve your dreams. Akbar, this has been a pleasure. Thanks a
lot. Thank you so much. Really I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Hope you enjoyed the conversation with Akbar. If you'd like to see it, search for it on YouTube. This weekend on KTLA, it's a conversation with my filmmaker friend, Billy Ray. He's the writer-director behind a limited series coming to Showtime at the end of this month, based on the memoir from former FBI director James Comey. The show is called The Comey Rule. And we'll talk to Billy Ray about the series before it airs on Showtime. As always, thanks for the kind reviews on Apple Podcasts and on social media. If you'd like me to see your feedback, just tag me at Frank Buckley TV on Twitter and on Instagram, or post a comment on my Facebook page. We drop a new podcast every Wednesday, and we air a new TV show on KTLA every weekend. Thanks for joining us this week, and until next time, I'll see you on TV.